Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 9th of January, these are our main stories. The American Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who's in Israel, has said that it's not in the interests of any country to see the Gaza conflict escalate. The French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, has stepped down as President Macron tries to revive his embattled government. One of the legends of international football, Franz Beckenbauer, has died at the age of 78. Also in this podcast,
humpback whales are extremely diverse vocalists, and one of the more common call that we see throughout the world is one of these low-frequency, sort of broad-spectrum drop or whoop call.
We speak to the scientists who say they have been talking to a humpback whale. As fears rise that the war in Gaza could escalate into a wider Middle East conflict, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has been visiting Arab nations trying to calm the rising tensions. On Monday, the Lebanese group Hezbollah said one of its commanders had been killed in a suspected Israeli strike. Mr. Blinken, who is now in Israel, urged restraint.
It's clearly not in the interest of anyone. Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah, for that matter, to see this escalate and to see an actual conflict. And the Israelis have been very clear with us that they want to find a diplomatic way forward.
The Hezbollah commander killed in Lebanon has been named as Wissam al-Tawil. While Israel has not confirmed it carried out the killing, a government spokesman warned Hezbollah to back off.
Hezbollah is dragging Lebanon now into a totally unnecessary war, the war that Hamas began. It is risking dragging Lebanon into the sort of ruin that the people of Lebanon do not deserve, that we do not deserve. And we're now at a fork of the roads. Either Hezbollah backs away, or we will push it away.
Since the Hamas attacks on October the 7th, as well as the devastating war in Gaza, there have been near daily exchanges of fire between Israel and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon. The death of this Hezbollah commander comes a week after another Israeli strike on Lebanon killed a senior Hamas leader there. Our correspondent in Beirut, Hugo Beshega, told us what is known about this latest killing.
Hezbollah hasn't really given details about the role that this commander played, Wissam al-Tawil. Reports here suggest he was a senior commander at the group's Radwan force, and that he was killed in an Israeli drone strike in southern Lebanon. And Hezbollah has published a picture of him alongside leader Hassan Nasrallah. So this shows that he was a prominent figure, significant figure inside the group. And I think he's the most senior Hezbollah officer killed so far in this wave of violence between Hezbollah and Israel. Now, Israel hasn't confirmed it was behind the killing. The military said it had carried out attacks targeting Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon today in response to attacks that had been carried out by the group. And I think this shows how tense the situation is along the Lebanon-Israel border. And the fear here in Lebanon is that this violence could escalate and this could become a major conflict between Hezbollah and Israel.
Yes, that is a big fear. And we saw last week an Israeli strike on Lebanon which killed a senior Hamas leader. Now this week we're hearing that Israel may have been behind the death of this Hezbollah commander. Why would Israel be carrying out such attacks given the fears about this conflict escalating?
So in Israel, you know, some senior officials have been defending a larger offensive against Hezbollah to try to stop these attacks, to reduce the threat posed by Hezbollah, which is this powerful organization supported by Iran, and also to allow the return of tens of thousands of residents who have been evacuated from northern Israel because of these attacks that have been happening almost every day. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today was in northern Israel saying essentially that the Israeli military is ready for a confrontation with Hezbollah. The Israeli defense minister as well has said that it is imperative to restore, you know, security in northern Israel and that these attacks from Hezbollah need to stop. So you do have some people in Israel defending a much stronger approach when it comes to Hezbollah to try to stop these attacks from the group.
Hugo Bashaga. Well, as we mentioned earlier, the US's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, is now in Tel Aviv, and he's expected to again urge Israel to do more to reduce civilian casualties. Our correspondent, Paul Adams, assesses Mr. Blinken's visit.
During a previous visit to the region at the end of November, Antony Blinken told Israel to change the way it was fighting, to kill fewer civilians and cause less mass displacement. Gaza's health officials say almost 250 people have been killed in the past 24 hours alone, and huge numbers are still on the move. More than 1.5 million Palestinians are now huddled in the southern city of Rafah, many of them in flimsy tents. The UN says 90% of children are facing severe food poverty, and the three major hospitals in central and southern Gaza are teetering on the verge of collapse. Gemma Connell is from the UN's Office for Humanitarian Affairs.
Cause for hope is very difficult when I see everyday kids like Mahmoud, who I met yesterday, a 9-year-old who'd just been hit all over his body by shrapnel, and another child who had been hit by an airstrike and had no idea where his family was. In the face of those stories and the eyes of these children who carry fear and trauma, it is very difficult to have hope.
Israeli military officials say their campaign has entered a less intense phase. That's not yet how it feels to the people who live in Gaza, or perhaps to the scores of Israeli hostages who've now been held there for more than 3 months. Today, a video released by Palestinian Islamic Jihad showed a 47-year-old Israeli hostage, Elad Katsir. It's been well over a month since any hostages were released. Negotiations aimed at bringing others home seem to have broken down.
Paul Adams. France's Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, has resigned after less than 2 years in the job. Her replacement is expected to be named in the coming hours. As Hugh Schofield reports, it had been widely expected that Ms. Borne would lose her job as President Emmanuel Macron tries to boost his political fortunes ahead of European elections later this year.
A day of fevered speculation in political circles in Paris ended with the resignation of Prime Minister Borne after a grueling 1.5 years in office. Handicapped by her lack of an outright majority in Parliament, she nonetheless fought hard to see through two important pieces of legislation on pension reform and immigration, and also led the country through the riots of last July. But with important European elections approaching, which the nationalist right of Marine Le Pen is widely tipped to win, President Macron clearly feels the need for a fresh team to take over. The new Prime Minister is expected to be named on Tuesday, with the Education Minister and Macron loyalist Gabriel Attal emerging as favourite. At just 34, he would be the youngest Prime Minister in modern French history.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Europe's largest economy, Germany, has already gone through months of turbulence as it looks to fill a funding gap of around 17 billion euros. Now there are signs the economic situation might be about to go from bad to worse. On Monday, farmers in the country blocked a number of roads with tractors and trucks at the start of a week-long protest against government subsidy cuts, which they say will drive them out of business. Ministers had already said the support would be phased out over time, but that's done little to convince farmers like Carla Klussmann, who was at a demonstration northeast of Berlin. She's also concerned about the influence of far-right politics in these protests.
We are standing up for better conditions for our daily work. We need fair prices for our hard work to be able to live from our production. This would enable us to produce more sustainably and after social conditions. But for this, we need financial support from the state. Also, currently, we can see people from right groups who are floating our movement. We need to stop this.
I heard more about the demonstrations from our correspondent in Berlin, Jessica Parker.
I mean, it'd be wrong to say that the whole of Germany has been brought to a standstill. These things are inevitably a bit patchy, so long lines of tractors have popped up on some motorways, obviously causing disruption, but not in other areas. There was, though, one VW plant that experienced blockages today, for example, and there have been some states that have said, look, if you can't get to school, the students, then you might need to learn remotely today. So there certainly has been disruption as farmers have gone out across the nation to really try and make their voice heard over their discontent, not just about these planned cuts to fuel subsidies, but actually speaking to some of the people at the protest here in Berlin today, a kind of sense of wider discontent, actually. They feel they're being squeezed by green policies, the green transition, by bureaucracy as well. So this seems to have been the straw that broke the camel's back, as one campaigner put it to me.
As you say, this is part of a much wider discontent with Olaf Scholz's government, in particular its handling of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor, is under a lot of pressure at the moment. You've got a few things going on. This was all sparked, this proposal to roll back these tax breaks for farmers, because they were trying to find savings after the budget crisis that you were mentioning before, when the Constitutional Court ruled that their 2024 budget was unlawful as they tried to repurpose pandemic funds. And they've been trying to find ways to plug this gap. And that's now sparked this controversy amongst farmers. And then on top of that, you've got a train driver's strike that's due to start on Wednesday. So there'll be further disruption as well. So I think a very difficult start for the year for Olaf Scholz and his traffic-light coalition of three parties.
And on top of that, there's also concern that extremists are trying to further increase tensions at demonstrations like these.
You see, there was one particular incident last week where the Green Party Vice Chancellor, Robert Habeck, was trying to get off a ferry returning from holiday with his wife in northern Germany, and protesters had gone there to meet him, and scenes got pretty heated, and he didn't in the end get off the ferry, and it went away, and he ended up disembarking somewhere else later on. And that really spread, or caused some condemnation, as people saying we mustn't let this debate get too radicalised, too overheated. But the other element as well is that it's pretty clear that the far right are trying to harness this debate. So, for example, the Alternative for Deutschland's co-leader Alice Weidel has been talking about how she would actually double farm subsidies as a way of trying to show that her party is getting behind the farmers, and her party continues to poll pretty highly ahead of all the three governing coalition parties. So it's certainly something the far right is trying to tap into.
Jessica Parker in Berlin. On the anniversary of an uprising in Brazil, when supporters of the former president Jair Bolsonaro attacked government buildings, the current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has said that the individuals who financed and organized the violence must be punished. Lirada Rocha reports.
President Lula described the unrest as a right-wing coup attempt supported by his predecessor Jair Bolsonaro. He said that those behind the riots deserve no pardon, as forgiving them, he said, would encourage future attacks on Brazilian democracy. Mr. Bolsonaro denies involvement. During the ceremony, restored paintings, sculptures and a valuable copy of the Constitution were returned to Congress. They were among the objects damaged by thousands of right-wing activists who stormed the presidential palace, the Supreme Court and the Congress a year ago.
Leonardo Rocha. The German footballer Franz Beckenbauer, who is widely seen as one of the greatest players of all time, has died at the age of 78. He's one of only three men to have lifted the World Cup, both as a player and a manager. Franz Beckenbauer helped change the way the game was played, and the German Football Association said he influenced football like no other. Our sports correspondent Joe Wilson looks back at his life.
Franz Beckenbauer stood at 5 feet 11, but his command of football made him a giant. Der Kaiser was his nickname. On the pitch, he played at the back, but Beckenbauer didn't simply defend. He began attacks with control, authority, freedom, the so-called sweeper role. Beckenbauer was the leader. He played for divided post-war Germany, the western part, 104 times. In 1974, they took on a celebrated Netherlands team in the World Cup final in Munich and won.
President von der Schiel gives the new World Cup to Franz Beckenbauer, the captain of West Germany.
In club football, Beckenbauer captained the dominant Bayern Munich to three consecutive European Cups in the mid-1970s. His playing career included later spells in New York before he became the manager of West Germany in 1984. In 1990, he won the World Cup again, this time as the boss.
There it is! West Germany win the World Cup for the third time and equal the record.
Beckenbauer's unique status in Germany made him a natural choice to lead the country's successful bid to host the 2006 World Cup. He was later charged with corruption linked to the bidding process. The trial against him ended without a verdict. But in the first truly global era of football, there was Bobby Moore, Pelé and Beckenbauer, the names that made the game. In Germany, Franz Beckenbauer set the exalted standard all footballers there seek and are expected to follow.
Joe Wilson reporting. Still to come.
5, 4, 3. We have ignition and liftoff of the first United Launch Alliance Vulcan rocket.
A perfect blast-off, but now a US space mission, due to be the first for half a century to land on the moon, has developed a technical hitch.
A web of manipulation and terrifying abuse.
If he'd have said to do anything, I would have done it.
With a powerful religious figure at its centre.
There was no safe place.
You don't say no to him.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service is back with a brand new season, investigating allegations surrounding the preacher, T.B. Joshua.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. China says it's detained a foreign national accused of spying for the British intelligence service, MI6. Beijing alleged that the person in custody was a business consultant who'd been trying to collect information within the country for years. Our security correspondent Gordon Carrera reports.
In a statement, the Ministry of State Security said the spy came from a third country, implying they were neither British nor Chinese, and that they were recruited by MI6 in 2015. The British Secret Service was said to have provided the individual with training and specialist communications equipment as they travelled into China on multiple occasions and then provided MI6 with secret and confidential information. The BBC has not been able to independently verify the claims, and the UK government has a policy of neither confirming nor denying matters relating to intelligence issues. The Chinese statement said the individual was the head of a consulting agency overseas. China has been engaged in a crackdown in the last year on foreign business consultants operating in the country, accusing them of gathering sensitive information. Beijing has also launched public campaigns to raise awareness of foreign spying and increasingly has been publicising cases of alleged espionage by Western countries. Previous incidents have focused more on alleged activity by the CIA. Accusing Britain's MI6 is more unusual.
Gordon Carrera. A US space mission, due to be the first for half a century to land on the moon, has developed a technical hitch. The spacecraft blasted off successfully from Cape Canaveral in Florida on Monday. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
It had started with a picture-perfect rocket launch that put the Peregrine spacecraft on just the right path to reach the moon next month. But within hours, Astrobotic, the company that had devised the mission, was reporting major problems. Peregrine was struggling to keep its solar panels pointing at the sun to provide essential power. Engineers quickly identified a fault in the propulsion system, and although Peregrine was eventually made to point the way it should, the spacecraft was losing fuel. Astrobotic conceded a lunar landing looked impossible, and that it was now thinking about what could be salvaged from the mission's original objectives. The US Space Agency has put 5 instruments on Peregrine to study the moon's surface environment. It's unclear what science could be done, even if the Astrobotic craft is only able to orbit the moon and not land.
Jonathan Amos. The tech giant Apple has begun making payments to millions of customers in the US more than 3 years after agreeing to settle claims that it deliberately slowed down the operating speed of some iPhones. Each claimant will receive just over $90 as their share of the $500 million settlement. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, has been following the case.
Back in 2017, Apple confirmed something that many older iPhone owners had long suspected. It was deliberately slowing their devices down. The company had introduced a power-saving feature to the operating system for some models, and the result of that was that they worked more slowly. Apple said it was intended to prolong the life of these devices as the batteries aged and became less powerful. But it hadn't informed customers, and after a backlash, it eventually agreed to offer battery replacements. A group of those affected launched legal action against Apple in the US, and today the firm has settled without admitting responsibility. Justin Gutman, who's leading similar legal action against the firm in the UK, said the US payout didn't guarantee success here.
It doesn't help in terms of moving my case forward dramatically. But the case is a good case, and there are so many million people involved that I'm enthusiastic about this. You have to be, otherwise you would never start.
Apple said it had no statement, but as previously said, it would never intentionally shorten the life of its products. The iPhone battery will hold at least 80% of its charge for 500 cycles. A cycle is one full charge from 0 to 100%. A 50% charge counts as half a cycle.
Zoe Kleinman. The SETI Institute in the US is best known for its research into the possible existence of extraterrestrial life. But the non-profit organisation is also interested in contacting non-human life here on Earth. Researchers from SETI say they've managed to communicate with a humpback whale called Twain. James Reynolds spoke to some of the scientists that worked together on the project, SETI astrophysicist Lawrence Doyle, biologist Fred Sharp from the Alaska Whale Foundation, and biologist Brenda McCowan of the University of California. So what did they talk about in the conversation with Twain the whale?
We're not entirely sure. We do know that the call that we recorded the previous day is a call called the Whoop, which Fred can talk about more specifically. And it's thought to be a contact call. You know, we may have been saying something like hello back and forth for 20 minutes, but we're not entirely sure yet because we haven't decoded the communication system of whales. That's our next goal.
Fred, tell us about that call. I think Brenda called it the work call.
Yes, humpback whales are extremely diverse vocalists. And one of the more common call that we see throughout the world, both in migration, feeding and breeding, is one of these low frequency, sort of broad spectrum drop or whoop call has been the object of study by teams around the world. And we believe that it's one of these sounds, maybe like a flock of birds where they just make this call every so often to sort of stay in contact. And of course, because their calls travel so well through the water, they can be miles apart, but still be confabulating.
Lawrence, did the humpback, to your estimation, think that it was in contact with another humpback?
Oh, now that's a very good question, because it did circle the boat, but it didn't see another humpback. But it did match the temporal variations that Brenda was putting in. So in other words, the probability that it was having a conversation, you might say, or a communicative exchange was very high. It was the going back and forth of matching the temporal duration that really made it look more like a conversation. Whether it... That's a good question. I don't know. That's a very good question. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that I get the sense that it came up sufficiently close to the vessel to realize that it was not another whale, although we may have recorded its sound from the previous day. So it was maybe even thinking it was looking in some form of acoustic mirror. And until we decode the web call, maybe it was asking if we had any gray poupon.
Brenda, did that 20-minute communication or conversation, as we describe it, did it follow the normal rules of communication that we humans have, that kind of I do my bit, then I listen, or at least pretend to listen when you're talking?
Yes. So it's turn-taking, and that's exactly what we do in human language. And so, yes, it does follow similar rules. Other species also turn-take, though, too, because you have to, of course, listen and also speak, right, in order to exchange information. So I would say it probably follows a pretty fundamental principle of communication.
The behavioral biologist Brenda McCann talking there to James Reynolds. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.